You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your pods. I'm Campbell Barron, or at Campbell J. Barron on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Welcome to the program. If you've ever spent more than 15 minutes with me, you probably know that I listen to a lot of podcasts. And this may not sound surprising, seeing as I have my own. However, ever since I started listening to podcasts every day, back in around 2015, the ability to quickly process information and tap into the thoughts of insightful leaders while walking, while taking the bus, just really appealed to me. And one of the biggest pieces of advice you often hear when it comes to building a startup is the timing of your company. And it seems like most startups only really have the short window of time when that concept would actually work. Anything before is too early, and anything after is just too late. And so a lot of startup success is determined by finding that sweet spot. And someone who's found that sweet spot, Mike Mignano, he's the co-founder of a startup called Anchor.fm. And Anchor is a perfect example of a company that has surfed the podcasting boom with perfection, all the way to a $100 million sale to Spotify early in 2019. Mike now runs Anchor from the inside of Spotify, in addition to the teams developing Spotify's creator tools. His insights regarding the podcasting space, in addition to Mike's lessons learned building the company, really piqued my interest. And as a power user of Anchor.fm myself, I knew I wanted to have him on the program. And it took a few months and a rescheduled interview, but I'm happy to say that we made it happen. New York is where Mike calls home. We chatted via Zoom a few weeks ago. This is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. I hope you're having a great day today. My conversation with Anchor co-founder Mike Mignano starts now. Well, Mike, thanks for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Campbell. This is a long time in the making. I'm glad we could finally make it happen.
I think first and foremost, if you can introduce yourself, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Mike Mignano. I'm one of the co-founders of Anchor. And I now work at Spotify after Spotify acquired Anchor back in February of 2019. So yeah, I basically run the team that looks after products like Anchor and also products like Spotify for podcasters, basically all of the podcaster tools that Spotify builds and maintains.
And Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. That was your startup that got you into the Spotify world. Talk about it.
No. I think in general, the notion of making podcast creation super easy has always been what we've wanted to do. I think since the beginning, like, our mission was to democratize audio. And if podcasts are the medium that everyone wants to create for right now, then we want to make making a podcast super, super easy for anyone.
And I would say you've succeeded at that mission. And we'll get into it. But before you started Anchor, before we kind of get into the inception of the product and your co-founder and then the Spotify deal, in your years leading up to building Anchor, what were you doing? What were you like? Were you into startups? Were you into tech? How did you kind of fall into this?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think fall into this feels pretty accurate because, it definitely wasn't something we had been sort of plotting or planning on for a long time. My background was I came out of at a school, a CS major, so I came out coding, you know, maybe slightly before it was, you know, it was the thing that everyone wanted to do. And I think as a result, I had somewhat of a negative impression of it. I actually came out and wasn't super thrilled with what I was doing. I was working for some consulting firms and just kind of bored, to be honest, and decided that I wanted to move away from tech and I wanted to move away from coding. And I wanted to pursue my passion, which was music. I grew up a musician, playing music, playing the drums. And so basically did everything I could to get a job at a major record label. Got a job at Atlantic Records back in, no, this is a while ago. I can't even remember the year now. Back in maybe 2007. And basically just did anything I could to get my foot in the door. So I started actually as a freelance web developer. So leveraging my CS degree and, you know, my ability to code and things like that to get a job there. But my goal was actually to ultimately transition out of anything related to tech and really work purely on the music side. I think I wanted to work in A&R and like artist development and stuff like that. Yeah. So I did that for a while. I ended up being there for about 5 years. And while I was there, somehow I got reinterested in tech. The iPhone launched when I was there. I think, you know, there was this notion of software development almost becoming democratized in a way. Like, there were lots of things happening that made making a really compelling product or app that could be used by potentially millions and millions of consumers much, much easier, much more realistic. And I think through that, I actually ended up getting really interested in startups and tech. And ultimately, after being there for a couple of years, decided to leave music to go to a startup, you know, a true early stage startup. It's called Aviary. Mm-hmm. And Aviary made photo editing tools for everyone. They basically wanted to make it such that anyone could create like really, really compelling work through photo editing and photo creation right from their smartphones. This was like kind of around the time that Instagram was really taking off. So this was still like sort of a novel concept. But the mission of that company really resonated with me, and it was to democratize creativity, right? To be able to empower anyone and everyone to be creative, even if they didn't necessarily have that skill inherently or that natural born talent. That business did fairly well. We went on to get acquired by Adobe. I worked at Adobe for a little while, which was a great company and very aligned with a lot of my values. But while I was there, my co-founder and I, who also had been at Aviary, we got very interested in podcasts. Mm-hmm. Really, really excited by podcasts. Serial.
And what year is this? At what time? This was before the boom.
This was 2014.
Okay.
So This was like 5-6 years ago. This was right as Serial was really taking off. Everyone, you know, was going crazy for Serial. Mm-hmm. I had just recently started listening to podcasts, you know, more regularly around then from Serial. I was listening to a lot of the Grantland Network podcast. That was Bill Simmons' previous media company. And we both were just fascinated by the space and we saw it growing. But we thought it was really hard to create for. We dabbled in creation ourselves a little bit, and we just felt like, man, making a podcast for, that you could get out onto platforms like Apple and Spotify was just really, really, really hard. And not only hard on the creation side, but I think we felt like more could be done on the consumption side as well. You know, right now you and I are recording this. We have an hour blocked off on our schedule. Not only is it, you know, is there work that goes into you making this episode, right? But I think there's also going to be some work on the listener side as well, and that it's a lot of content to consume. They have to really pay attention. Yeah. You know, it's hard to discover, et cetera. And so I think we felt like we could do stuff on the other side as well, and we could make it shorter form and shareable and more social and things like that. And so that was really the original inspiration for Anchor. So we just got sort of hacking away on what probably more closely resembled a social audio product. And before we knew it, you know, a couple months in, we had a healthy beta community. We were, you know, we were just obsessed with working on this thing, and we decided to quit our jobs and go full time. And that's kind of how we fell into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fell into it would be, I took a gamble there and it paid off in terms of the wording. Cause sometimes people are like, no, I didn't fall into it.
I wanted this all my life.
Yeah. I was destined to succeed since 5 years old. So a few things I picked up there. One, you got interested in startups and you decided to work at a venture backed startup to kind of get the lay of the land.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs do. And I think it's very beneficial. My day job is at a startup. So I do this podcast. I'm trying to grow my listener base. I do it on the side, but I'm really interested in startups. And I figured when that opportunity came up, I thought it'd be a great idea to kind of get the lay of the land. So I think that's really cool. And second, you kind of like, you totally rode the wave of podcasting beautifully. Like, if you kind of look at the time and place you were in, you were discovering podcasts in 2014. You mentioned Serial was blowing up. That's when I started listening to Startup and a bunch of Gimlet shows too.
Yep.
And so as a result, like, you can have a great idea and a great product, but many great ideas and great products are kind of ideas that have occurred many times over. And I've noticed it's really about the timing and, of course, great execution on top of that timing. And so when you originally had this idea, right now, I know Anchor, and anyone listening to this on Anchor or who knows Anchor knows it is like the easiest way to make a podcast, right? That's your slogan. That's your branding around the platform. But in the early days, was it the easiest way to make a podcast, or was it like this audio social network? What was your ambition? Because ideas change. And so just talk about that.
Yeah. So I can definitely talk about that. I just want to, before that, I want to comment on the timing thing. I mean, I think that is such an important point that I certainly didn't realize earlier on, and only realize it now in retrospect, that market timing is maybe the biggest determinant of whether or not a startup will be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you talk to people that have gone through it or you talk to investors, I think that's why you hear time and time again as a founder or as an early stage company that burn matters so much, right? Your cash flow matters so much, because if you're early, the key to nailing market timing is just surviving long enough to coincide with the perfect market timing.
Yeah.
And obviously, as a startup, surviving long enough is an exercise of conserving your cash, right? And you're conserving your burn. So yeah, I think it's interesting you pick up on that, because, you know, we definitely did not have the right market timing in the beginning, in the early days of Anchor, nor were we trying to nail the timing. We were just excited about something. You know what I mean? But yeah, but to your question about the social product, it was not what it is today. It was not this, you know, all-inclusive, super easy to use, you know, podcasting platform that you could do all from your phone or your desktop and wind up on every major consumption platform. It was a social platform. And I think, you know, that speaks to what I was saying earlier around how we really wanted to solve both sides of the market. Like we saw issues on both sides, and we felt that we could tackle both sides. I think what we learned pretty quickly that while we were having success getting people to create the content, we were struggling getting people to listen to it in our platform on Anchor. And we made a number of adjustments early on to try to improve that. Like, you know, the earliest days of Anchor, the product was, you could only create 2 minutes of audio content. You know, we had these episodes. Podcasts. Yeah, exactly. We had these things called waves. These were like essentially micro podcasts. They were 2 minutes in length. And the recording functionality was extremely simple. It was really just a microphone. There was no editing. It was really just like record, listen back, publish. Yeah. So we were getting people recording, and I attribute that to the fact that we had made, you know, what felt like podcasting to be really easy, and there were these social dynamics that were pulling people back in through notifications and things like this. But listening was really hard. So what we did to try to improve that was we started improving the overall quality. We removed the 2 minute limit and we made it more long form. We started to add in super creative tools like, you know, interludes and sound effects and music and getting voice messages from your listeners. And we just made it really easy to create something with a little more substance or production quality to it. And that really helped. You know, we saw the quality of the content increase. We saw listenership go up, but still it was hard for a creator to convince people to leave their preferred app of choice wherever they listen to other types of audio content and come into this new app that only had some of the content and only had a, you know, shorter form version of it. And so that's when we really started to see that people wanted, the product had evolved to a point where the content early days was very, very short form and lightweight. But by the time we had this realization, it actually did kind of feel like a podcast. You know, it felt, it was longer form. It was richer and more substantive in terms of production quality. So the only difference really was that it wasn't available on places like Spotify and Apple.
Yeah. And you weren't branding it as a podcast.
Correct. Correct. We weren't branding it as a podcast. So I think that's when we realized we're actually doing a disservice to the creators here. It would be much more beneficial to them and probably to us if we actually open this thing up and push this content out to where people were listening. And that's really where the current value prop of Anchor was born, through that realization. And that's what we did. And that's really what sort of kicked off this wave of growth that I think, you know, you mentioned we've sort of rode the wave of podcasting. I think that's what sort of triggered that. And the timing, you know, per that previous point that we were each making around market timing was not intentional. It happened to be when we found product market fit and realized what this product could really, really provide value for.
Yeah, I love it. And so, okay, so we have Anchor V1. I mean, was it called Anchor at that time when you originally launched? Was that the...
Yeah, it was called Anchor.
So it was called Anchor. So you had Anchor V1, like these little micro podcasts. They weren't called podcasts. It sounded much more like an audio social network. Am I right about saying that it was almost Twitter style, where it was like a feed of little... Yeah. Waves. Yeah. Okay. So audio social network, mobile, I'm guessing. Right. And then you kind of stumble into this podcasting wave. You realize that more people are trying to basically listen to your programs off, or the content on your app off the app. And so maybe you should do distribution, which was probably a good idea. And then you kind of just evolve it. And my question is, so in between we have Anchor V1, which is like social, and then Anchor V2, which is much more of like a podcast distribution platform, the easiest way to make a podcast. In between those two waves, they often call where you're working on a startup, but you haven't found product market fit. They call that the trough of sorrow, where the gears kind of just aren't clicking. Did you Did you ever get discouraged? Were you ever kind of like looking around wondering why you weren't the next Facebook in the early days for V1?
Yeah, I mean, the trough of sorrow is definitely a term I've heard as well. And I think in my experience working on Anchor and other founders I've talked to, you know, I think there are many or multiple troughs of sorrow, you know, the early days of a startup. And, you know, you said you're at an early stage startup, so maybe you can relate to this. It definitely feels like a bit of a roller coaster, right? Where,
yeah,
you know, one day you're at a high, and then the next day you're at like a really deep low. And it sort of ebbs and flows like that, right? You have these big, big wins, you know, big successes. Maybe, you know, maybe you score like a, you know, a big deal, or, you know, a surge of new users or something. And then, you know, maybe a few months go by and nobody's using your product anymore. And you're sort of wondering what the heck's happening. So can totally relate to the trough of sorrow, and definitely went through not just one of those. I think many of those. I think, you know, we had one fairly right out of the gate, in that when we launched the first version of Anchor, the more social version, there was a lot of excitement around it. There was a lot of attention. There was a lot of press. There was a lot of investor interest. There was a lot of acquisition interest, literally within the first
acquisition
couple of weeks.
Interest.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Literally within the first couple of weeks. And I think, I know that sounds crazy.
No, it's crazy.
And I think it's because Anchor, like a social audio platform, not that nobody had ever tried social audio before, but for whatever reason, I think that struck a nerve with a lot of people, especially in like the Silicon Valley sort of tech community. I think it excited a lot of people. It was different than what everyone had just seen for the past couple of years that was so squarely focused on photos and videos. And it brought in this rush of attention and engagement, you know, high profile investors and celebrities and things like this using the product. And so, yeah, in those early days, you're like, oh, wow, you know, we made it. What, you know, we did it. Anchor's
going to
be...
Actually, so you didn't feel like you were in the trough of sorrow when you were theoretically in it.
Well, so no, right out of the gate, it was really, really exciting. But then, which always happens after a big surge of excitement for a product or a startup, you know, people are fickle, and the true nature of the product starts to emerge, right? Like all of the hype dies down in the metrics and the engagement. You start to see what the real behaviors are, and that's when you see like what's actually happening with the product, and you're like, oh, maybe this isn't working the way we thought it was.
Yeah.
So we had that pretty early on, but we were also extremely willing to ship fast and iterate and learn, and we were not precious at all about what we were doing. You know, I don't think, maybe never in the history of the company did we become so attached to any one product idea or initiative. We were just constantly sort of like searching for the perfect product market fit. Yeah. So even when it stopped working, we just kept iterating and kept iterating and kept following the user feedback. And it's funny, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but we launched the first version of Anchor, say in like March or something like that.
Of which year?
2016.
Okay.
And based on that initial excitement, we immediately decided that we needed to invest in an Android app. And so we hired this guy who was an amazing Android engineer and amazing member of our team. And, you know, he raced to build an Android app.
Oh, no.
You know, it took him a few months.
Yeah.
But during those months is when we realized that iteration of Anchor was not working. So literally right after we shipped Android, honestly, within weeks, we decided we were sunsetting the version one of Anchor and moving on to the next one. That was a really, really painful moment for all of us. And I imagine especially him, because he had just sunk a lot of time into it. But, you know, him and the rest of the team, we got right back on it and we moved on to what was next, which was, you know, the next version of Anchor that was based on many of the realizations we got on the first one. So
yeah. And so how much did you raise?
Before we got acquired, we had raised, I think, just under $15 million.
Okay, fair enough. And so a substantial amount of money. You can put that to good use. And in 2019, you merge with Spotify. They announced they acquired two companies, Gimlet and Anchor. Both of them I have consumers and users of. And so I'm guessing you've heard the startup in regards to Gimlet's acquisition, Thanksgiving in Stockholm. And unfortunately, that's all I have to reference. And I'm sure it was different in your situation. But did you have an infamous meeting with Daniel Ek? Did you go to Stockholm and meet with him? And did he grill you about the future of Anchor?
So, I mean, let's see, what can I say here? So I was in a really fortunate position to start building a relationship with Daniel early on in the history of Anchor. You know, again, back to early days Anchor when it was a social product and definitely getting a lot of interest and excitement from people. You know, Daniel was one of the people that reached out to me early on, and we just formed a relationship over our mutual interest in product and audio. And, you know, we both have young families. So we stayed in touch on and off throughout the year. So when it did come time to, you know, discussing an acquisition, it wasn't like there was this, you know, this one big intense meeting that, you know, where yeah. we were getting grilled, but, you know, but we did talk a lot about a lot of our conversations, especially, you know, when we were talking about potentially merging companies, did focus on the future. And the big thing that Daniel said to me that really resonated, I think, with both me and my co-founder Nir, was that Spotify really wanted to give Anchor superpowers. You know, again, you're at an early stage startup. You know what it means to have limited resources in terms of time and money and having to ruthlessly prioritize everything you do. I think Daniel's point was, hey, you know, if you join Spotify, you know, you're joining the biggest audio streaming platform in the world. You know, you're joining a product that's got 250 million plus listeners.
Yeah.
Think of the amazing things we could do together. Think of the, you know, the incredible data or analytics you could tap into. You know, just think about the talent and the infrastructure you get from being aligned with such a world-class organization. So I think that's what was most appealing to me. And I think, you know, what also was really, really appealing to us was the alignment of missions, right? You know, we were trying to democratize audio. Spotify's mission was and is, you know, to make it possible for 1 million creators to live off their work and unlock the power of human creativity. So lots and lots of alignment and missions just kind of was a no-brainer. I mean, just if you think about all the companies that are in the space, the one that is so squarely focused on audio above all other things is Spotify.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was just, I think it was a perfect merging of two super similar missions and teams and visions for the future in terms of product.
Yeah. No, I saw it right away. I think there's definitely, I wasn't surprised. And the day after the acquisition, what happens? I'm curious.
The day after the acquisition,
yeah.
Man, that whole time is a blur if I'm being totally honest. You know, leading up to the acquisition, I'm sure you've heard this before. It's a pretty intense process. There's, you know, there's diligence, there's paperwork, there's a lot of phone calls with lawyers, all the while you're running a business, right? Because, you know, if an acquisition doesn't go through for whatever reason, you know, you got to keep things moving. So I wasn't getting a lot of sleep at that time. And some of the details are a little fuzzy, but I will say that because of the alignment, you know, it was kind of, let's get back to work. It's not to say we just picked up the very next day. Obviously, we had to inform the team. You know, we had to really wrap our heads around what it meant to be a part of Spotify, go through onboarding and things like that, meet a lot of people, a couple of trips to Stockholm. But given the alignment of vision and missions, like, it was a very much like, okay, how do we get back to work but do it bigger and better now? You know, we initially stayed in our original office, so it wasn't like everything looked and felt differently overnight. We've since moved offices. We're now in the Spotify office, although right now we're not in any office because you know, everyone's working remotely due to COVID. Mm-hmm. But I think it was, you know, if you've talked to people whose startups have been acquired, you know, I'm sure you've heard horror stories about integrations and, you know, forcing others to work different ways and, you know, culture shock and all these sorts of things. We never really had that because there was so much alignment up front, and we sort of gradually merged the teams. Like I said, we were originally in our own office. Then, you know, we ended up sort of over time going down there. And yeah, so I don't know. I wish I could say that there was like a very distinct moment or feeling on that day after, but it was more, I would think it was more gradual and very, very positive all around.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is typical. I don't think most acquisitions are.
No, like, I think the statistic is most acquisitions don't work out. Coming up, my conversation with Anchor co-founder Mike Mignano continues. So we'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsor. You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. Welcome back to the program. And I'm about halfway through my conversation with Mike Mignano. He's the co-founder of Anchor, so we're going to jump right back into that conversation. So as someone who sees podcasts being essentially created left, right, and center, through Anchor, through Spotify, distributed all over, do you think we're going to hit a point, or have we already hit a point, where the supply for podcasts, even good podcasts, far, far, far exceeds the demand? And there are just too many podcasts available. There's, you know, like if you started a podcast in 2015 and you kept it going, you're probably much better off than starting a podcast now. And I think as time goes on, it seems like the window is just, I don't want to say closing, but just much more competitive. Do you think podcasts have exceeded the supply?
No, I definitely do not. I think we're still in the earliest innings, if I'm being honest. I mean, I think if you look backwards, maybe you'll think that. Maybe you'll think that, you know, the window's closed because you look at like the markers by which somebody measures success of podcasts published, you know, publicly. And it's usually like, I think whether or not you've cracked the top charts, right? That's been one of the biggest discovery drivers. But I think if you look at other really scaled content platforms, especially platforms that have nailed discovery, you start to see that there can actually be an ocean of content if discovery does a good enough job of matching listeners with the right content. So like right now, it may seem like it's oversaturated in that it's probably pretty hard for somebody to launch a podcast today and crack the top 25 or the top 10 on the podcast charts. But if the podcast charts aren't really what's driving discovery, and you as Campbell or you as any other podcast are able to find an audience through other means, then that shouldn't matter. And maybe there's a lot more room to go in terms of demand, right? So I think that constraint, that like lack of true discoverability, is probably a temporary constraint on both the supply and the demand side. Yeah. I think Anchor helps on the supply side, and you know, we're seeing that. We're seeing podcaster growth just explode. I mean, I think Daniel announced on the recent Spotify earnings update that, you know, that Anchor is now powering something like 60% of the Spotify podcast catalog.
That's ridiculous. That's crazy.
Know, and like, and seven, I think 70% of the new shows that launched, you know, over the past few months or something like that are powered by Anchor. So
that's nuts.
I think like that speaks to the explosion on the supply side, per your question or your point. I think now what needs to happen to really accelerate that and accelerate the demand side is improved discoverability and personalization. And that was another reason I think I was so excited by Spotify. Just to go back to the previous topic, you could argue in terms of audio, like no company in the world has done a better job at solving audio discovery than Spotify through, you know, things like the Daily Mixes and Discover Weekly and whatnot for music. So I think this is a challenge that can be overcome. And I think if you're just looking to comparable mediums, like let's say video or YouTube, you know, there are so many creators on some of those other platforms and so much more content than what's in podcasting that I think we've got a long ways to go.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, definitely when you compare it to other platforms, where it seems like we're quite early. And how have you noticed podcasts grow? Because you mentioned like the charts, that seemed like a very 2014, 2015 thing where you can release a show and then maybe get a little shout out and it can surge the charts. That seems, unless you have a, you know, large following, it seems more difficult to do now. So how do you see discoverability in terms of the podcasting landscape evolving?
I think the things that have worked well, and I would love to hear if you agree with this, because you're a podcaster and I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. I think the things that work well are the things that drive in the audio medium. Like if you ask another podcaster the question you just asked me, I think like most of the time the answer will have something to do with guests, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you need to get a great guest on your podcast, or you need to go guest on another podcast. And to me, that speaks to the fact that I think that most discovery of audio content currently happens most effectively in audio, mm-hmm. right? So if you say in this podcast episode that somebody should go listen to another podcast,
yeah,
that's probably going to be more powerful than you going on Twitter and telling yeah. people to listen to a podcast.
How I've discovered 90% of the shows I listen to.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think whoever solves discovery, I think, you know, one of the key ways will probably have something to do with audio, right? Like mm-hmm. the actual like recommending or discovery or personalization or something in the context of audio. Yeah. Because what I've seen, just this is me personally, you know, and shows I've been on or other podcasters I've talked to, I've heard that visual forms of media don't really work that well for driving podcast discovery, whether it be on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. That's not to say you shouldn't use those things, right? Because I think it's always important to leverage every channel you can to build your brand. But I think audio will always convert better to audio, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, like one of the most literal examples of that was, I think a Gimlet show that was launched pretty early on, and it was called Sampler. And it was literally a podcast about other podcasts.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that now.
Yeah, I think I listened to a couple episodes. I don't think it's still around today. It's definitely a problem. Like I've heard people say it isn't a problem, but I think that's also could be a interpretation of everyone has a podcast. So that means there are enough to listen to, but that's not the problem, is finding quality podcasts.
I tend to hear that it's not a problem or that there are too many podcasts from people who have well-established podcasts.
That's fair enough.
which I think like is maybe a biased take, right? I mean, if you already have a successful podcast, you don't have a discoverability problem with your show. Yeah. If you already have a successful podcast, you probably also don't want a lot more competition to your podcast. Yep.
There might be some hidden motivations there. If you're doing your work with, if you're under Spotify, you have Anchor. When Anchor was acquired, there's a panic that lasted 10 minutes. Oh, is Anchor still going to distribute on other platforms, right? Because they're acquired by Spotify. And I think there was that panic with Gimlet. And I think every time Spotify's acquired a podcasting company or a network, or I mean, whether it's podcasts, et cetera, that's kind of always been, oh no, are they the podcasts I like, am I still going to be able to get them? Now, as a Spotify insider yourself, the Joe Rogan deal was like jaw-dropping on many spectrums. And I'm pretty aware that you didn't negotiate that deal. And I'm also pretty aware that you're not allowed to say anything that probably wasn't disclosed. But what are your thoughts on that as someone who's in the podcasting space, has seen kind of, you know, Gimlet shows and other shows being released a few days ahead on Spotify, but always still having their Apple Podcasts Overcast base. And now, you know, starting by late 2020, the biggest podcast in the world, I'm pretty sure, is going to be available on Spotify exclusively.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak super specifically to, you know, some of the Spotify questions you just asked there, but I think I can speak to my perspective on this from an Anchor perspective and speak to some of that panic, I think, that you mentioned, because I did hear this when Anchor got acquired, and you know, I also anticipated it to some extent. Yeah. And so, you know, so it was something we thought about and we talked about a lot going in. And basically what it came down to was, look, Anchor is a creator first platform. Like the only reason you use us, I hope, is because you feel like we're solving problems for you, the creator, right? Like you're not going to use us if we don't deliver on the value proposition that we offer, right? Yeah. And one of the things we do as a creator first platform is everything we can to help you get heard wherever you want to get heard. And so in that respect, like I think our view was, hey, if we didn't distribute to all these other platforms, creators wouldn't trust us. And if creators didn't trust us, we wouldn't have a business. And so while we may be owned by Spotify, you know, like I said, baked into Spotify's mission is about, you know, helping creators. And that's certainly what Anchor is about. And mm-hmm. so that's where our heads are at on this thing is like, it's important for creators to be on other platforms right now. So we want to help them with that. Yeah. We don't want to try to force them into something that is not aligned with their values.
Mm-hmm. And aside from podcasting, when you had your exit with Spotify, like many post-exit successful entrepreneurs, you decided to take up angel investing on the side. I mean, you know, that's probably, I don't think there's too much to unpack here because it seems quite logical, but was your motivation for angel investing to make some more money? Was it, did you feel this obligation to kind of give back to the startup ecosystem? How did you make that decision? Because not everyone does it. You know, you can, there are a wide range of ways you can give away money and put money in different places and invest it in other places. So what's your, what was your thinking behind that?
Yeah, I think it's, it was mostly about out of those two things, the latter, you know, about, I would say in some respect, giving back. I don't know that it's fair to, at least the way I've thought about it. I never feel fully comfortable in saying like, oh, I'm giving back through angel investing because there is, you know, whether you're financially motivated or not, you are getting something for your investment, right? You're getting equity or whatever in the company. But I will say that it's more than like a, not really a financially motivated thing for me. More, I like working at the early stage level. Like it really excites me. It really excites me to work on early stage product. It excites me to think through go to market. It excites me to think through strategy and fundraising. And if, you know, early stage investing is a way for me to stay involved and help out with a team or a product or a founder that I think is doing something really cool or unique, then it's a great opportunity for me. So that's really what it's about for me. And the investments that I've done, definitely, like, I love the founders and I love the product. Like, you know, it's either like a product I would use personally, or like I very, very, very much identify with the problem, or I just think the founder is amazing and they're just somebody that I want to spend time with and support in any way I can. So that's really been the motivation for me. And it's been a lot of fun. All of the ones I've done are early, and, you know, investments like these things obviously take a while to play out. You know, no idea how they will perform, although I'm obviously very, very bullish on the companies, or I wouldn't have invested in them. But even in the you know, the year or so that I've been doing this, it's just so much fun for me just to like be able to contribute at that level.
Yeah. I mean, like, the main motivation for this podcast is talking to people that I admire and are kind of doing things that I'm really interested in. One of those things is angel investing. I don't have money to angel invest at this point. I have a spreadsheet of companies I would fund if I did have money. And so I'm curious about that. When you write an angel check at this point, do you expect to get a return on investment? When you fund a startup, is it more of like, oh, I love the idea, let's give this a shot? Or it's like, oh, you know what? I actually think I'm going to make some money with this company.
I think, like, given that the money has value and, you know, and it's not unlimited, I definitely need to be thoughtful about the investments like I make. Like, I definitely am not in a position where I can just be like, oh, who cares about this money? You know, like it has value to me. So obviously I am hoping that the company is successful and I want to do everything I can to make them successful. But like I said, that's not my main motivation. My main motivation is to be able to work at that level, at the early stage level, and help out a founder that I think is trying to do something really great for the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's great that kind of pushing it back into the ecosystem. And aside from podcasting, if you were going to start a startup in 2020, what industries would you target? What spaces really interest you? In other words, what are some really disruptible industries that you see? You successfully rode the wave of podcasting well. It's clearly not over, but this is just a hypothetical question. In 2020, your contract with Spotify ends and you're on your own and you're ready to start a company.
So to clarify, definitely not leaving Spotify in 2020. No, yes, that's the hypothetical scenario.
This is just what industries interest you.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny, these trends pop up, especially among sort of the investment community in Silicon Valley. And I'm often a skeptic in some of them. Like, you know, I'm sure you saw it as well because you're plugged into a lot of this stuff. But remote work, future of work stuff was huge even before COVID. Everyone was talking about it. I was somewhat skeptical, to be honest. Now, post-COVID, it's so obvious that there are many, many new problems and challenges people face in the workforce due to remote work. And so that, I think, is an interesting area, of opportunity, because I think it's going to accelerate a lot of things that were already happening pre-COVID as far as people moving to a more distributed workforce. Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting. You know, if you look at the investments I've made, they are aligned, or some of them are aligned with similar approaches that we took at Anchor that I've always really been fascinated by, which is, you know, really around the democratization of making things, right? I get really excited by tools that enable people to make stuff. So for example, I invested in this company called Universe, which makes it super easy to build a website, like a really functional, including e-commerce tools, mm-hmm. website from your mobile phone. That's really, really exciting to me because it lowers the barrier. But, you know, then similar along that path, like, I think things like the no-code movement excite me because...
Yeah, I had Emmanuel who started Bubble on the program.
Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
So I'm a big fan of the no-code movement.
Yeah, but because it's the same theme, really. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, putting tools in the hands of people to make stuff where they couldn't previously make stuff. That's really mm-hmm. powerful to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I really like Lead. Do you follow Lee Jin at all?
No, I don't.
She wrote this whole thesis on the passion economy for Andreessen Horowitz.
Oh, that's a smart. That's interesting.
Yeah, I love the passion economy. So yeah, those are some spaces I think are super interesting. And then, you know, another thing that I always think a lot about, and I think a lot of people think about this, but I also am nowhere near an expert or really know anything about it in a way that I feel like I can meaningfully contribute is climate, right? Like I'm definitely thinking often about climate, but I have no domain expertise.
You kind of have to start an electric car company to make a big impact. It's the barrier to entry is a little bit higher, just a little bit. But yeah. I mean, and so what about your thoughts on, it seemed like in 2016, there was this idea that voice was kind of going to take over the world, not just podcasts, but like devices like Echo and Google Home. And then it almost seemed like that kind of faded away. And then now with COVID, I'm starting to see more and more insights in regards to the future of voice. Do you think that there's an opportunity to build on top of these smart speakers? Do you think that, I mean, like if you look at platform shifts, right, you have web to mobile, then you have mobile to, there's like a bunch of question marks. What's it going to be? Do you think that there's an opportunity there?
I think there is. That was one of my early hypotheses about Anchor and like why, like one of the reasons we were really excited about Anchor. I would say I haven't seen a lot of signal yet from the companies that create these devices that they're yet super interested in that. The devices seem to be gearing more towards, I would say, like entertainment mm-hmm. and information than anything else, right? Like play me this music or tell me the weather or give me this. Like they haven't opened up the toolkits in a way that I think that would enable, you know, say, you know, really easy, seamless communication, you know, distributed or mm-hmm. the creation of content like we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really going to ultimately be up to them. And now maybe they just don't have ambitions for this sort of thing, or maybe they're not seeing anything compelling in the data yet that would suggest that people would even do this sort of thing. But I think it really starts with them. And I think if the platforms were to enable really innovative type products like that to be created, I think you would see developers creating for it and experimenting and then we would see. I do think that COVID could be an accelerant.
Yeah.
For some of the
stuff. A lot
of
people say COVID's an accelerant in a wide range of industries.
Yeah, because one of the things specifically is around work, I think. Mm-hmm. I think so voice with work. I think one of the things I'm personally struggling with at work, I mean, I've heard lots of my peers and other people say the same thing, is like, because we're all remote now, to have a conversation with somebody, you have to schedule a Zoom or a Google Hangout. And therefore, everything is turning into a really heavy meeting that is usually at least 30 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so there's this breakdown, I think, that's happening in sort of quick ad hoc, just like human conversation. Mm-hmm. It's all becoming very structured and rigid and like heavy.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if there's an opportunity either through one of these voice services or, you know, even through something like Zoom or Slack or Google or whatever, to just like make these type of interactions a lot more lightweight. And I think that could do a lot for productivity and also just in general human communication at a time where we're all distributed.
Yeah. Do you, as someone who's benefited from the mobile app store tremendously, do you think it's dead?
The app store?
Yeah.
I think it depends how you define that. I mean, it's obvious. I think mobile apps are not dead, but I think, you know, for companies who maybe in the earlier days of the app store really rode the wave of some of the discovery tactics and things like this to quickly amass, you know, huge followings or huge install bases. That does seem to be becoming harder and harder. And I don't even know that it's the fault of the app stores. I think it's more that there's been a lot of sort of consolidation and growth around a couple of major companies, you know, mm-hmm. the Facebooks, the Googles, the Snapchats of the world. But I think that then becomes a question of whether or not these companies or these products become their own platforms. I think it's been pretty interesting to see. It feels like SnapKit has become an opportunity for a new wave of developers to build based on that as a platform and gain some real traction. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know if you've seen that. Like, there have been a couple of SnapKit apps that have like really taken off.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, before we wrap up, I have some rapid fire questions for you. So,
let's do it.
Answers. Who is someone you admire?
Someone I admire, man. I mean, there are a lot of people.
This isn't the number one person you admire. Just someone you admire.
Yeah, I mean, I could say something really obvious, like, you know, my parents, or or Daniel Ek. You know, I think if your audience is tech focused and entrepreneurial, I mean, somebody in the space that I've always been a huge fan of, and I was fortunate enough to report into him at my time at Adobe, and fortunate enough to have him as an investor, an anchor, is Scott Belsky. Mm-hmm. I think when I think about product, when I think about product strategy, I look to a lot of his advice. There's a blog post that I share with my team often, my product team often, called Crafting the First Mile of Product, that I think is just incredibly thoughtful and poignant. And yeah, I think he's somebody I admire in the space greatly.
Yeah, I love it. MVP when building it, like most valuable person, not minimum viable product, when building Anchor, other than your co-founder.
So like early days Anchor, who could we not have done it without?
Yeah.
Oh, hands down, Maya Prohovnik, who was, you know, was one of the first employee on the team. She was just so instrumental in the company's success. And she now actually runs product and all of what we call R&D. So that's like product, design, engineering, data. She runs all of that for us now. She's just an incredibly thoughtful product leader who so understands creators and more broadly, just like users of products and how to build empathy with them and build great experiences.
Favorite book of all time?
Favorite book of all time. So I'm a real sucker and nerd for Kurt Vonnegut, actually. Like, I'm into like Kurt Vonnegut sort of nerdy, goofy brand of sci-fi. I've always been a huge fan of Sirens of Titan.
So your favorite book isn't The Lean Startup?
No. No, although I think there are some really good lessons in there.
Yeah. And lastly, describe Daniel Ek in one word.
Genuine.
Fair enough. Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Great to get to talk to you.
Yeah, Campbell, likewise. This was awesome. Great meeting you, and can't wait to hear the podcast.
That's Mike McDaniel, one of the ones who succeed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I really appreciate it. If you want to see clips from the show and stay up to date with what I'm working on, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Campbell J. Barron. And my YouTube channel is my name, Campbell Barron. You made it to the end of the show. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Campbell Barron, and I'll be back in no time.